This week, we're going to spend an hour on a single number that almost nobody who relies on it actually understands, the false positive rate of an eye writing detector. Before we start, here's what's been nagging at me. The whole appeal of these tools is that they convert a hard human judgment into a clean percentage. You paste in an essay, you get back a confidence score, and the score feels like a verdict. But a confidence score is not a verdict. It's a statement about the machine's uncertainty, not a fact about the student sitting across the desk from you. And somewhere in the gap between those two things, real people, students with visas, students with scholarships, students who write in a second language, are paying a cost that the marketing brochure never prints on the box. I want to understand that gap. Not the headline that a university switched off Turnitin, but the arithmetic underneath it and why it took us so long to look. You're listening to Tertulia, the eye conversation, slowed down. This week, the table is set around the false positive cost of eye detection in higher education. The tools that promise to tell a dean who cheated. The statistics that say those tools cannot do what they claim without convicting the innocent along the way. And the long, strange season in which the conversation talked itself from skepticism into optimism and back to skepticism again, while the math underneath never moved an inch. I've got four people at this table who have each been circling this from a different side, and I want to start by finding out what they've each been chewing on. Let me go around. I'll start with the person who actually knows what's happening inside these classifiers, because I think the whole conversation falls apart if we don't get that part right. What have you been thinking about this week?
Honestly, I've been thinking about how badly the word detector misleads people. When a university buys an A writing detector, the mental model the buyer has is something like a metal detector. You wave it over the essay. It beeps if there's contraband. The contraband is real. It's in there. The machine just found it. That's not what's happening. There is no contraband. There is no physical trace of a language model left behind in a sentence the way there's a fingerprint on a glass. What these systems actually do is measure surface statistics of the text. How predictable each word is given the words around it, how even the rhythm is, how little surprise there is across the whole document. And then they compare those statistics to a distribution they learn from training data and say, this looks more like the machine cluster than the human cluster. That's it. That's the whole trick. It's a similarity score dressed up as a forensic finding.
And the number it spits out, the 94% confident, or whatever it is, what is that number actually measuring?
It's measuring the model's confidence in its own classification. It is not measuring the probability that the student cheated. Those are different quantities, and the difference is the entire ballgame. The detector can be 94% confident and still be describing a property of itself, how far this text sits from its decision boundary. And that tells you almost nothing on its own about whether a human or a machine wrote it, until you also know how common cheating actually is in the population you're testing, which the detector does not know and cannot know.
We'll come back to that, because I think that base rate piece is the heart of it. Let me bring in the canon. You've been around long enough to have watched a few of these enforcement panics come and go. What's on your mind?
What's on my mind is that we have been here before, repeatedly, and we keep arriving as though it's the first time. There's a recurring institutional reflex, and it goes like this. A new technology destabilizes an old assessment practice. Instead of asking whether the old practice still measures what we wanted it to measure, the institution reaches for a machine that will let it keep the old practice unchanged. The calculator did this to arithmetic instruction. The internet did this to the research essay. And now generative writing has done it to the take-home essay. In every case, the seductive move is the same. Preserve the artifact and outsource the enforcement to a device. What troubles me is that the outsourcing is never neutral. The device doesn't just enforce the old rule. It quietly changes what the rule means, because it can only see what it can measure, and what it can measure is never quite the thing we cared about.
Say more about that, the device changing what the rule means.
The rule used to be, don't submit work that isn't yours. That's a rule about authorship and intent. The detector cannot see authorship, and it certainly cannot see intent. So in practice, the rule silently becomes, don't write in a way that resembles the machine, and those are wildly different rules. The second one punishes a style, not an act. A student who writes plain, even, careful, regular prose. Which, by the way, is exactly what we spend years trying to teach them to do, is now closer to the danger zone than a student who writes in a baroque, idiosyncratic, error-strewn way. We have built an enforcement tool that is most suspicious of the writing we most reward. Nobody decided that on purpose. It fell out of the measurement.
That's a sharp inversion, and I want to sit with it. Let me bring in our skeptic, because I suspect you've got questions about whether the problem is really as bad as the headlines say.
I do, and I want to be careful here, because there are two failure modes in this conversation, and I don't want us to fall into either. One is the vendor's failure mode, which is to oversell the tool. The other is the critic's failure mode, which is to assume that because the tool is imperfect, plagiarism isn't real, and nobody is actually using these models to cheat. Both of those are wrong. Students absolutely are using generative tools to write their essays. That's not in dispute. And I don't want anyone listening to think the skeptical position is cheating is a myth. It isn't. The question I keep pressing on is narrower and, I think, more uncomfortable. It's, what is the actual measured false positive rate? On what population, under what conditions, and who has audited it? Because I notice that everybody in this debate, vendors and critics alike, throws around numbers like 1% or 3%, and I want to know where those numbers come from before I build an argument on them.
That's fair, and I want to hold you to it later, because I think you're going to push the rest of us to show our work. But let me ask the obvious follow-up. Does the exact number matter if the structural problem is what our technologist described? If it's measuring style instead of authorship?
It matters enormously, actually, and here's why. The structural critique, that it's a probabilistic classifier on a rare event, that's true, but it's true of every classifier that's ever been useful. Cancer screening is a probabilistic classifier on a rare event. Fraud detection is a probabilistic classifier on a rare event. We don't throw those out, we manage them. So the question can't just be it has false positives, therefore it's illegitimate, because that proves too much. The question has to be, what is the rate? What is the cost of each error? And is there a workflow around the tool that makes the combination tolerable? That's the honest version of the skeptical position, not burn it down. It's show me the numbers and show me the workflow.
I appreciate that framing because it raises the stakes of getting this right rather than just lowering them. Let me bring in the last voice, who I think is going to be comfortable sitting in exactly the ambiguity our skeptic just opened up.
I'll be honest, what I keep coming back to isn't the rate at all. It's the asymmetry of who absorbs the error. Because here's the thing, the cancer screening analogy misses. And I say this as someone who finds the analogy genuinely tempting. When a cancer screen throws a false positive, the next step is more testing. The false positive triggers a follow-up that can clear you. The error is, in principle, recoverable, and the system is designed around the assumption that it will be wrong sometimes, and so it builds in the correction. With an A detector in a lot of institutions, the false positive doesn't trigger a follow-up. It triggers an accusation. The flag is the end of the process for a lot of overwhelmed instructors, not the beginning. And so, the question of what's the rate becomes inseparable from what happens after the flag. And what happens after the flag is wildly variable and mostly invisible. So I find myself less interested in the second decimal place of the false positive rate and more interested in the fact that we've built a tool whose errors land on whoever is least equipped to contest them.
And who is that, in your reading?
It's pretty consistent. It's the second language writer. Because formulaic, drilled, careful prose reads as low surprise to the detector, and low surprise is exactly what gets flagged. It's the student who doesn't have the cultural fluency, or, frankly, the confidence to march into an office and say, your machine is wrong, and here's my draft history. It's the student for whom an academic integrity flag isn't a bad afternoon. It's a visa, a scholarship, a deportation, a future. The cost is not distributed by lottery. It concentrates. And it concentrates on exactly the people who were already closest to the edge. That's the part I can't put down.
So let me try to state the question this episode is actually about, because I think you've each handed me a different facet of it. The surface question is, do A detectors work? But underneath that, there's a sharper one. We have a tool that converts a hard human judgment into a clean number. The number is misunderstood by almost everyone who uses it. The errors it makes are structural, rather than fixable, and those errors fall hardest on the people least able to fight them. The question is why an institution would buy that, what it thinks it's buying, and whether the thing it's actually buying is, and I'm borrowing the column's phrase here, absolution from the labor of judgment. Does that feel like the right frame?
That's exactly right. And the phrase, absolution from the labor of judgment, is the one I'd underline. Because the detector isn't really sold to catch cheaters. It's sold to relieve a person of the burden of deciding. Judging a real plagiarism case is awful. It's adversarial. It's time-consuming. You might be wrong. And if you're wrong, you've harmed a student. The detector offers to take that weight off you. It says, you don't have to decide. The machine decided. Here's the number. And that offer is enormously attractive to an exhausted, over-enrolled faculty. The tragedy is that the weight didn't go away. It got transferred. It landed on the student.
That's the thread we'll pull for the next hour. Let me zoom out and put it on the timeline, because I think the most interesting thing here is how the conversation moved while the math stood still. I want to do the longitudinal section now, because the column makes a claim I find genuinely arresting. It says there were two arcs moving at two different speeds. One was the conversation, the discourse, which lurched from skepticism in late 2024 into a long season of optimism through the first half of 2025, and then soured again. And the other was the underlying statistical reality, which never moved at all. It was true before the first detector shipped, and it'll be true after the last one is switched off. I want us to trace both arcs. Let me start with the discourse arc. Technologist, you watched the optimism season happen. What did it actually sound like?
It sounded like management. That's the word I'd use, the grammar of that whole period. And you can see it across the corporate think pieces, the IBM style, 10 dangers and how to manage them, genre, was, name the pitfall, then immediately hand over the management plan. The danger is always positioned safely upstream of a procedure. So, the move was never, this doesn't work. It was, this is a risk. And here is how we govern the risk. And that framing is incredibly powerful because it lets deployment proceed. You invoke the caution precisely so that you can keep going. The caution becomes the permission slip. We've considered the risks is the sentence that lets you buy the thing.
So the optimism wasn't, it works, it was, it can be made to work.
Exactly that, and that distinction is everything, because it can be made to work is unfalsifiable on any given Tuesday. Whatever's broken today is a tuning problem, a next release problem, a threshold you haven't calibrated yet. The framing converts a structural impossibility into an engineering roadmap, and engineering roadmaps are reassuring. They imply that competent people are on it.
And I'd add that this is an old, old rhetorical structure. There's a whole genre, you saw it with every information technology of the last century, that stages the fear in the title and then resolves it on the side of the future. Promise or peril? Powering the future or fueling our fears? The body delivers the verdict, and the verdict is always, proceed. It's the rhetorical equivalent of a coin that's weighted. You're allowed to call it in the air, but it lands the same way every time.
Can I push on the optimism a little, though? Because I think there's a part of it that was sincere and even reasonable, and I don't want us to be too cynical about it. The fraud detection analogy was doing real work for people, and it wasn't crazy. There's a genuine insight in there, which is that machines actually are good at weighing the subtleties of millions of transactions and surfacing the weird ones. That's a real capability. Fraud detection across millions of online transactions is a place where a model can see patterns no human could. So I understand why people looked at that success and thought, catching cheaters is just fraud detection, wearing a mortarboard, and reached for the same tool. The mistake wasn't stupidity. It was a misplaced analogy.
But that's the thing. The same person who gave us that fraud detection example gave us the warning in the very same breath, and the optimism season declined to hear the second half. The point was never just, AI is handy for fraud detection. It was the most tempting problems to solve, with AI are also the ones prone to class imbalance. The temptation and the danger are describing the same systems. They're not two observations. They're one observation, and the discourse took the first clause and dropped the second.
Unpack class imbalance for the listener, because I think this is the technical heart of the arc.
Class imbalance just means one of the two things you're trying to tell apart is rare. Most submitted essays are honestly written. Cheating is the minority class. And the trouble with a rare class is that you can build a tool that looks spectacularly accurate by doing almost nothing. If 5% of essays are A-written, a detector that simply says honest every single time is 95% accurate. It never catches a single cheater and it's still 95% accurate. The so accuracy, the headline number vendors love, is nearly meaningless on an imbalanced problem. The numbers that matter are the two you have to pry apart from it. How often does it catch a real cheat, and how often does it convict an honest student?
And here's the brutal part of the arithmetic. That second rate, the false positive rate, gets multiplied by the size of the honest majority, which is huge. So imagine a detector that's actually pretty good. It flags only one honest essay in 100, 1% false positive. That sounds precise. That sounds like a tool you'd trust. Now run it across a university that processes, say, 100,000 essays a term. 1% of the honest essays is 1,000 wrongful flags. And how many real cheaters are there? Maybe a few thousand, and you don't catch all of them. So you can easily end up in a situation where the number of innocent students you've accused is the same order of magnitude as the number of guilty ones you've caught, or larger. The false alarms can outnumber the true catches, with a tool that on paper is 99% accurate.
That's the base rate fallacy, classically.
It is, and I want to be precise because this is exactly the kind of claim I'd interrogate if someone else made it. The reason a 1% false positive rate produces 1,000 wrong accusations isn't a trick. It's just that 1% of a very large honest population is a large absolute number, and that large absolute number is being compared to a small, real population of cheaters. The rarer the thing you're hunting, the worse this gets. And there's no amount of cleverness that escapes it as long as the event is rare and you test everyone.
Let me bring in the second structural problem, because the column makes a point that I think is even more damning than the base rate. The idea that these tools don't detect authorship at all. Technologist, there's a parable about a fish that I think is the cleanest way in.
The Tench, yeah. It's the best teaching story we have. Somebody trains an image classifier to recognize a particular fish, a tench. The thing performs beautifully, and then they open it up to see what features it's actually keying on, and it turns out it's not looking at the fish at all. It's looking for human fingers against a green background, because every training photo of a tench was a proud angler holding up their catch. So the model learned human fingers plus green outdoors and called that tench. It was never detecting the fish. It was detecting the hands of the people holding the fish.
And the writing detector learns its own version of the hands.
Precisely. It learns the correlates of machine text, even rhythm, low surprise, clean construction, a certain flatness of register. And then, anybody who writes that way without a machine's help is the fingers in the frame. They get flagged not because they cheated, but because they resembled a proxy. And who writes plain, even, low surprise prose without any machine, a second language writer who learned English through formulaic construction, a neurodivergent writer who's been drilled into rigid structure. a student who was taught, correctly, to write clearly and avoid flourish. The error isn't a bug you patch in version 2. It is what the system is. It's looking at the hands the whole time. It was never looking at the fish.
And this is where I think the discourse arc really failed, because this isn't new knowledge. The Tench example, the class imbalance warning, these were in the popular books years before the first detector shipped. We didn't lack the analysis. We had the analysis on the shelf. The optimism season just talked over it. That's the part that haunts me. It's not that we were ignorant. It's that we knew and proceeded anyway, because proceeding was rewarded and stopping wasn't.
I want to introduce the third multiplier, because I think it's the one institutions understand least. There's a statistical idea about testing many things at once, the multiple comparisons problem. Senior academic, this is your territory.
It is, and it's beautiful and damning in equal measure. The principle is old. If you run an experiment once and you get an improbable result, that improbable result means something. But if you run the experiment 10,000 times, an improbable result means almost nothing, because somewhere in 10,000 tries, the improbable becomes the expected. If you flip enough coins, someone gets 10 heads in a row, and that person didn't cheat. The volume manufactured the anomaly. The statisticians have a correction for this. You have to multiply the unlikeliness of any single result by the number of times you went looking. The classic version is named after an Italian mathematician, Bonferroni. You discount your surprise by how many shots you took.
And a detector run across an entire university
is running that experiment tens of thousands of times every single term, every paper, every section, every course. So somewhere in that volume, the machine will produce a flag that looks near. Certain, a 99% confidence against some particular student, purely as a function of how many dice it rolled. That student did nothing. The high confidence flag is not evidence of guilt. It is sampling error wearing a uniform. But the institution reads the high number as proof, because nobody applied the correction. Nobody multiplied the surprise by the number of attempts. And so, the volume of testing, which feels like thoroughness, is actually what guarantees the wrongful accusation.
Now, here's where I want to register a disagreement, because I don't think it's quite that clean, and I don't want us to overstate it into something a vendor could rightly knock down. The multiple comparisons point is real, but it assumes the flags are independent draws and that there's no human in the loop adjusting the threshold in a well-run process. And I grant you these are rare. The detector flag is a screening step, not a verdict. The actual accusation requires a human to look at the draft history, the version control, the writing process. If you have that, the multiple comparisons math is mitigated, because the second stage isn't blind. So I'd push back on the idea that the statistics doom the practice regardless of workflow. The statistics doom the practice as it's typically used, which is flag equals verdict. But that's a claim about institutions, not about mathematics.
I'd accept part of that and resist part of it. You're right that a genuine second stage changes the math, and I shouldn't have implied the statistics alone settle it. But I'd push back on how much that second stage actually exists. In my experience, the draft history defense is available to a vanishingly small number of students, the ones who happen to have used a tool that logs versions, the ones who know to keep their drafts, the ones with the confidence to assemble a defense. So the workflow you're describing is real in the policy document and rare in the lived process.
And I'd accept that. So maybe where we land is, the disagreement isn't whether a good workflow could fix the math. It's whether the good workflow is ever actually present. You think it almost never is. I think it sometimes is, and that the conversation collapses an almost never into a never, and that the slippage matters because it hands the vendor an easy rebuttal.
I'm going to let that one stand unresolved, because I think it's a real and productive split, whether the statistics condemn the tool, or whether they only condemn the way the tool is typically deployed. Let me bring in the publication's own arc, because we've said things adjacent to this before.
We have, and I think there's an honest delta to name. The publication's prior pieces on the social aspects of AI made a fairly general argument that systems sold as neutral arbiters tend to redistribute their errors toward people already short of standing. That's true, and we've said it more than once, but it was always pitched at a fairly high level of generality. What's different this week, and what I think is the actual contribution, is that we can now name the precise mechanism. It's not just AI is biased in the abstract. It's a specific statistical pipeline, rare event classification, plus a proxy that correlates with the writing style, plus mass testing without correction. And you can trace exactly how a stylistic difference gets converted into a presumption of guilt. The prior pieces gave us the pattern. This week we can show the gears.
That's the right way to build on it rather than restate it. Let me put one more thing on the timeline, the souring. Because by the third quarter of 2025, the critical share of the conversation started climbing again. What changed?
What changed is that the most heretical sentence in the whole debate finally got said out loud, and it got said from inside the industry, which is what gave it teeth. The sentence was, "Not every problem needs A. The right number of deployments for a given problem is sometimes zero, and the discipline worth cultivating is the discipline of declining." That's a remarkable thing for a solution architect to publish, because their whole job is to deploy, and it's the closest the discourse came to catching up with the math, because the math had been saying exactly that the whole time. Plagiarism is a real problem. It does not follow that a probabilistic classifier is the answer to it. The long optimistic middle treated that inference as automatic, and somebody finally said, it isn't.
And notice the courage it takes, structurally, to say that, because the whole economy is pushing the other way. There's this competitive dynamic where adopting A starts to create separation between the institutions that move and the ones that don't. So declining to deploy feels like unilateral disarmament. You're resisting a peer pressure gradient that punishes the abstainer. And that's why not every problem needs IA lands as heresy. It's not heresy against the technology. It's heresy against the market.
There's a money piece here, too, that I don't want to skip, because it's part of the arc. The budgets kept growing even as the returns didn't.
Right, and this is the part I find genuinely strange and worth dwelling on. There's survey data showing that a large share of companies measuring their ACOST savings came in well below their targets, landing under 10% savings when they'd hoped for much more, and yet 90% of them increased their budgets again the next cycle. So the returns disappointed and the spending grew. That's not a rational market responding to evidence. That's something else. That's a market where the procurement decision precedes the proof and renews regardless of the proof.
Because the thing being purchased isn't really the measured outcome, it's the feeling of having acted. The dean who buys the detector isn't buying a verified reduction in cheating. Almost nobody measures that. They're buying the ability to say, we take integrity seriously, we've deployed a tool. The detector is, in budget terms, an insurance policy against the accusation of inaction. And insurance policies renew whether or not you ever file a claim.
So let me try to draw the two arcs together before we move into the harder editorial section. The discourse arc oscillated, skeptical, then optimistic, then souring, and at every stage it used the same digits the statistics use. But it meant something different by them. The optimism heard 94% confident as a near verdict. The statistics meant 94% is a property of the classifier, not a fact about the accused. Same number, opposite meaning. And the place where the two arcs finally brush against each other is that late, grudging admission that some problems should be left unsolved. That's the meeting point. Everywhere else, they miss. Does that hold?
That holds. The rhetoric and the reality use the same digits and mean opposite things by them. That's the cleanest statement of the whole gap.
Then let's go to the part where we stop describing the gap and start arguing about what to do about it. I want to open the editorial act by letting someone stake out a strong position, and then I want the rest of you to come at it. Let me start with the strongest version of the abolitionist case because I think it's the one the column gestures toward. Newest thinking, give me the maximal claim.
All right, here's the maximal claim, and I'll own it and then probably regret it. All writing detectors should not be used in academic integrity proceedings at all. Not use them carefully. Not use them as one signal among many. Not at all. Because the failure mode isn't fixable, the cost falls on the vulnerable, and the very existence of the number corrupts the human judgment that's supposed to sit downstream of it. The moment an instructor sees 94%, they cannot unsee it. It anchors them. Even if you tell them, it's just a screening signal, the number poisons the well. So the only honest move is to not generate the number in the first place. Abolish the tool.
Okay, who wants it?
I'll take it, cordially, because I think the position is half right and the half that's wrong is doing a lot of damage to the half that's right. The anchoring point, that the number poisons human judgment, I think that's genuinely your strongest argument and probably correct. But abolish the tool overreaches in a way that I think actually loses you the policy fight. Because here's what happens when you say abolish detection. The dean says, so your proposal is that we do nothing about students wholesale outsourcing their writing to a machine, that we just accept it, and you've lost because you've let the abolitionist position be caricatured as the do-nothing position. The honest pushback the column itself makes isn't do nothing. It's do the harder, older thing, redesign the assignment, judge the rare, real case with human eyes. That's not abolition of effort. That's redirection of effort. And I think collapsing those is a tactical and intellectual error.
That's fair. And let me actually walk that back a step, because you're right that abolish the tool without. And here's what you do instead is irresponsible, and I led with the wrong half. Let me restate. The claim isn't do nothing about cheating. The claim is don't use a tool whose output you cannot defend in front of the person it accuses if the only evidence you can put in front of a student is a number that you yourself can't explain, that you can't say what it means, that you can't say why it's 94 and not 91, then you should not be using that number in a proceeding that can end someone's enrollment. That's the actual claim, and it's narrower than abolition. It's a due process claim, not a technology claim.
That's an interesting move. You've turned it from the tool doesn't work into the tool produces evidence you can't honor your obligations around. Senior academic, does that land for you?
It lands hard because it reframes the whole thing as a question of standards of evidence, which is the frame the academy actually has institutional muscles for. We have always understood, in principle, that an accusation requires evidence a human being can examine and the accused can rebut. The detector breaks that, not because it's a machine, but because its evidence is unexaminable. You cannot cross-examine a confidence score. The student cannot say, the machine is wrong because, and point to anything, because the machine isn't pointing to anything either. It's not saying, this sentence here matches this source there, the way old plagiarism detection did. It's saying, the overall vibe of this text sits closer to my machine cluster. There's nothing to rebut. And evidence you cannot rebut isn't evidence. It's an oracle. We don't run integrity proceedings on oracles.
I want to complicate this, though, because I think there's a version of the technologist's reflex that I need to talk myself out of in real time. My instinct, my professional instinct, is to say, okay, the tools are bad now, but the failure modes you're describing are partly tuning problems and a better calibrated tool that reported honest uncertainty. That said, I genuinely cannot tell. On the ambiguous cases, instead of forcing a number, would actually be useful as a triage signal. That was going to be my pushback. And as I say it out loud, I realize I don't believe it, or at least I believe much less of it than I did 30 seconds ago. Because the structural problems aren't tuning, the base rate isn't tuning, the proxy instead of authorship isn't tuning. Even a perfectly calibrated detector, that honestly reported its uncertainty would still be flagging the second language writer, because the second language writer genuinely does produce low surprise text. The calibration would be honest, and the harm would be identical. So my better tool pushback collapses, and I think I just talked myself out of it.
That's worth marking, because you came in as the one most likely to defend the tools on technical grounds, and you just gave up the technical defense.
I did, and I want to be precise about what I gave up and what I kept. What I gave up is a better calibrated detector fixes the harm. It doesn't, because the harm is in the proxy, and the proxy is load-bearing. What I'd keep is something much smaller. There might be a narrow, consensual, formative use where a student runs their own draft through a tool to understand how it reads, with no disciplinary stakes attached. Nobody else sees the number. That's a totally different object. That's a mirror, not a cop. But the moment it enters a proceeding, everything I just conceded comes roaring back.
Now hold on, because I want to test that mirror versus cop distinction, since I don't want us to let it slide by as obviously safe. Even the formative consensual use has a failure mode. If a student runs their honest draft through the tool and it comes back 80% likely I, what does that teach them? It teaches them to write less like themselves. It teaches them to add surprise, to rough up their prose, to perform humanity for the machine. You've now got students editing their authentic writing to fool a detector. They're not even being judged by, so the mirror isn't neutral either. It trains people to write for the classifier.
That's a good catch, and I'll concede the mirror leaks. You're right, there's no fully clean use, because the tool's existence changes how people write the moment they know it's watching. Okay, so maybe I retreat even further than I meant to.
Let me redirect us slightly, because I think we're at risk of all agreeing too quickly that the tool is bad, and I want to honor the skeptic's earlier challenge. Can we come back to something, you asked, in the first act, where the actual false positive numbers come from and who audited them? We've talked a lot of theory. What do we actually know empirically?
Thank you, because this is the question I refuse to let go of, and the honest answer is uncomfortable for everyone at this table, including me. We don't have a great independent audit. Most of the numbers come from the vendors themselves, who have every incentive to report the flattering rate, and they report it on benchmark datasets that don't look like real student populations. The independent studies that exist, the ones flagging second language writers at much higher rates, are smaller, and they have their own limitations. So when I press on, what's the rate? The truth is, nobody at the scale that matters has done the audit that would tell us, on a real diverse student population, what the false positive rate actually is and how it varies by group. And I think we have to say that plainly, because it cuts against the vendor and against us. The vendor can't prove it's safe. But we can't put a precise number on the harm either. What we can say is structural.
And isn't that absence itself the finding? The fact that a tool can be deployed across millions of students, ending careers, without a single large-scale independent audit of its error rate by group. That's not a gap in our knowledge that happens to exist. It's a gap that the procurement economy produces on purpose. The whole point of adopt first, audit never, is that the audit never happens. The unmeasured error rate isn't unmeasured by accident. It's unmeasured because measuring it would create liability.
Which connects to the thing the technologist said earlier about insurance, the budget renewing, whether or not you file a claim. If you audited the false positive rate by demographic group and it came back as bad as we suspect, you couldn't keep using the tool because now you'd have documented knowledge of disparate impact. So the institution is, in a weird way, protected by its own ignorance. Not knowing the rate is load-bearing. It's what lets the deployment continue. The mystification isn't a side effect, it's the product.
That's a dark thought, that the unexamined number is doing work precisely by being unexamined.
It is dark, and I'll go partway with it, but not all the way, because I don't want to assume bad faith where exhaustion explains it. I think for most institutions, it's not a calculated decision to stay ignorant. It's that auditing is expensive and hard and nobody's job, and the default is to not do the expensive hard thing nobody owns. So the ignorance is structural but not necessarily strategic. The effect is the same. The audit doesn't happen, but I'd resist the implication that there's a person in a room deciding to suppress it. Mostly, there's no person in any room thinking about it at all, which is, honestly, worse.
I'll accept the amendment. Banal neglect rather than active suppression. You're right that it's worse because there's no one to hold accountable. The harm has no author.
Let me bring the human cost back into the room, because we've gotten abstract again, and I think the abstraction is itself part of the problem. Newest thinking, you said earlier, the cost concentrates. Give me the concrete picture of what a false positive actually does to a person, so we're not just trading statistics.
Okay, picture an international student. English is her third language. She's on a scholarship that's contingent on good standing, and her visa is contingent on the scholarship. She writes the way she was taught, careful, structured, formulaic, because that's what got her through the English exams that let her come here in the first place. Her prose is low surprise, because she's writing in a register she drilled. She submits an honest essay. The detector flags it at 88%. Her instructor, who has 400 students this term and 11 minutes per essay, sees the flag and files an integrity report because the policy says two. Now she's in a proceeding. She doesn't have draft history because she wrote it longhand first and typed it up. She doesn't have the cultural fluency to know that she's allowed to push back hard, to demand the evidence, to lawyer up. She experiences the institution as an authority that has already decided. And the thing that decided was a number that, as we've now established, nobody at this table can fully explain and nobody has audited. That's not a hypothetical edge case. That's the modal false positive. The arithmetic guarantees there are thousands of her.
And the cruelty of it. Sorry, I keep coming back to the tench. The cruelty is that she got flagged for the same reason the classifier saw fingers instead of a fish. She is the human hands in the frame. Her careful, drilled, low-surprise writing is the green background. The tool was never looking at whether she cheated. It was looking at a feature that correlates with not cheating in the population it was trained on, and her honest writing happens to sit on the wrong side of that feature. She did everything right, and the proxy convicted her.
So let me try to name where we've actually landed, because I think the editorial position has sharpened over the last 20 minutes in a way I want to capture. We started with abolish the tool, which got walked back to don't use evidence you can't defend. The technologist gave up the better tool defense and then gave up most of the mirror defense. The skeptic held us honest on the missing audit and reframed the whole thing as a due process and evidence standards problem. Is the editorial line something like, the detector is not a safeguard, it's a transfer of risk from the institution that wants to be certain to the student who supplies the error rate out of their own record?
That's the line, and the word transfer is the one that matters because it makes visible what safeguard hides. A safeguard protects someone. The question a listener should always ask is, protects whom from what? And the answer here is that it protects the institution from the labor and the liability of judgment by transferring the risk of error onto the accused. The vendor sells certainty. The institution buys absolution from judgment. And the student pays the premium out of their own future. Three parties, and the one who pays is the one with no say in the purchase.
I'll sign that with one amendment I'd insist on for honesty's sake. The transfer framing is right, but we should be clear that the alternative, the human judgment we're championing, is also fallible and also transfers risk just differently. A human grader who decides, this feels I-written, without a tool is also running a biased classifier, the wet kind, and that one flags the same vulnerable students for the same stylistic reasons, sometimes worse. So the honest comparison isn't flawed machine versus perfect human. It's machine that launders bias into a number versus human who at least can be questioned, argued with, and held accountable for being wrong. The case for the human isn't that the human is accurate. It's that the human is accountable. The number absolves, the person can be held responsible. That's the actual difference, and it's a real one, but it's narrower and more defensible than machine bad, human good.
I think that's the most important thing. Anyone said all hour, honestly, it's not accuracy, it's accountability. The detector's deepest harm isn't that it's wrong, humans are wrong. It's that it makes the wrongness unownable. There's no one to appeal to, because the machine didn't decide, it just produced a number. And the human didn't decide, they just followed the number. And so, when the harm lands, there's no author of it. You can't get an accountable answer to, why was I accused? Because the honest answer is, a statistical artifact and an exhausted person who deferred to it. That's the machine the institution actually bought, not a cheating detector, a responsibility diffuser.
A responsibility diffuser. Hold that, because I think it's going to be where some of you land in the close. Let me move us there. Same question to each of you, about a minute each, and the only rule is honesty. Not a summary, not a takeaway. What most changed about your thinking this week? Technologist, you visibly changed your mind on air, so let me start with you.
I came in ready to defend a better tool. I really did. I had a whole position about honest calibration and uncertainty, aware detectors, and I believed it walking in. And what changed is that I now think the better tool dream is a trap, and I think it's a trap specifically for people like me, because it's the most comfortable thing an engineer can believe. It lets you stay in the room. It lets you keep working on the problem. We'll fix it in the next version is the sentence that keeps your job meaningful. And I watched myself reach for it in Act 3, and I couldn't make it hold because the harm is in the proxy, and the proxy is the whole tool. So what changed is that I think the Responsible Engineering Act here is not building a better detector. It's saying out loud, as someone who could build one, that the thing should not be built for this use, and that's an uncomfortable thing to find yourself believing, because it's an argument against your own usefulness. I didn't expect to end the hour there.
Skeptic. You spent the hour keeping us honest. What moved for you?
The accountability point moved me, and it moved me because I spent the whole hour insisting we couldn't condemn the tool without the numbers, and I still believe that. We don't have the audit. And I'd still throw a flag on anyone who pretends we do. But what I realized, somewhere in Act 3, is that I'd been asking the wrong question. I kept asking, is it accurate enough? And the answer to that is genuinely unknown. But the question that actually decides it isn't accuracy. It's whether the error is ownable, and that one I can answer without an audit, because the answer is structural. The detector is designed to make its errors unownable, to diffuse responsibility, so that no human has to stand behind the accusation. And once I saw that, I realized the missing audit isn't a reason to suspend judgment, it's part of the indictment. So I changed less about my standards of evidence, and more about which question the evidence was supposed to answer. That's a real shift, and I didn't see it coming when I sat down.
Senior academic, decades on the timeline. What's different?
I'll tell you the thing I'm least comfortable admitting, which is the right thing to say in this seat. I came in with my settled story. The recurring institutional reflex, preserve the artifact, outsource the enforcement. I've taught some version of that lecture for years, and I expected this to be one more instance of the pattern, which would let me feel wise about it. What I didn't expect, and what genuinely unsettled me, is that I don't actually know what the right assignment looks like on the other side of this. It's easy for me to say, design assignments that resist substitution do the harder, older human work. I've said it all hour, but when I try to picture, concretely, the assignment that a generative model can't do, and that's also fair to a working student with three jobs and no time for an oral defense, I don't have it. I have the principle and not the practice. And at my age, that's an unwelcome thing to discover, that my prescription is a gesture and not a plan. So what changed is that I've lost the comfort of my own conclusion. I still think the detector is the wrong answer. I'm no longer sure I know the right one, and I'd rather say that than pretend.
That's exactly the honesty the seat is for, and I think you've just delivered the, I don't know, that this show is supposed to make room for. Newest thinking, last word.
What changed for me is small, and I think it's the thing I'll actually carry. I walked in focused on who pays the vulnerable student the concentration of harm, and I still think that's the heart of it. But the phrase that came out of the room and surprised me was responsibility diffuser, because I'd been thinking of the detector as a bad measuring instrument, and I now think it's better understood as a device for making sure no one has to be responsible. And that reframes what the fix even is. If the problem were accuracy, the fix would be a better instrument. But if the problem is that responsibility has been diffused, then the fix is to reconcentrate it, to insist that every accusation has a human author who can be made to answer for it, by name to the student. And that's not a technology question at all. It's almost the opposite of a technology question. It's about refusing the thing the tool was bought to provide, which was the comfort of nobody having to decide. I didn't expect to leave thinking the whole debate was secretly about responsibility rather than accuracy. But I do, and I have, one of you to thank for the phrase, because it wasn't mine until it was said at this table.
That callback closes the loop nicely, and I think it's the right note to end on. That what looked like an argument about a percentage turned out to be an argument about who has to answer for a harm. Here's where I land, briefly, because I get a turn too. I came in thinking the scandal was that the detectors don't work. I'm leaving thinking the scandal is subtler and worse. That they work well enough to be trusted, and badly enough to be unjust. And that the gap between those two things is exactly wide enough for an institution to slip its responsibility through. The number was never the problem, the number was the alibi. Thank you all. This Intertulia is the weekly conversation from iNews Social, designed and edited by Dr. Diego Benila, with a cast of voices produced through Chatterbox on a single workstation. Next week, we return to the table. For now, thank you for spending the hour.